Mary Levy, it's back to school, and kids are in school, and there's a lot of media about that, but I haven't seen reported that DCPS, District of Columbia Public Schools, are having to make do with less this year. You study the budget extensively, which is difficult to do because, as I've heard you say, there's not a heck of a lot of transparency there. But one of the things you just testified at the DC Council and said that in middle school, there's only 5 middle schools that appear to have guidance counselors, and it seems to be major cuts that have not been reported on much.
Well, let's start with the school system. They had a $77 million increase this year, and yet they cut spending in the local schools. We do not know where that extra money is going, but they moved a number of functions out of central office accounts and charged the schools for them, while cutting the school's per pupil funding. So there is a tremendous amount of money someplace, but I haven't been able to find out where. And I do know that the local schools almost all have less per pupil funding this year than they did last year. And this is in a situation where there is a 5% pay increase for all teachers. And by teachers, I don't mean just classroom teachers. I mean teachers, librarians, guidance counselors, social workers. The special education social workers have all been moved into the local school budgets. And so schools are being asked to fund more functions with less money.
And you said you aren't able to find out where this $77 million increase is, and yet schools are now having to pick up more costs. How is that possible? Talk about the transparency or lack thereof of the DCPS budget.
When we asked about it during the budget process last spring, Chancellor Henderson said that much of that increase was due to a huge cost overrun in special education. What happened there is that, according to them, they went into the last school year with a budget that did not have enough money for the functions they were providing. So the council gave them $30 million extra. But there is no public information available on that updated budget for the current year. The only budget with any detail for the current year is the mayor's proposed budget as of spring 2010. So the school system got extra money during the course of last year. We don't know how they budgeted it. We don't know what they did with it. We don't know what kinds of shifts they may have made. We do know that some of the non-personnel spending for local schools was cut because the schools complained about that. And we do know that there were, I believe, some hiring freezes. It was hard to replace teachers who left. But the door on public information on any budget detail has been completely closed. I look at different, less detailed budgets, and I cannot even get two that have the same bottom line. In other words, every budget that I see adds up to a different sum of money total. Well, how can this be? How much money do they have? So I don't always know even how much they have. let alone what they're doing with it. The DC Freedom of Information Act actually has a provision called information that must be made public. And that includes all kinds of fiscal information for all agencies of the district government, including the school system. And when they say it must be made public, what they mean is that people are not supposed to have to even ask for it. It is to be posted on the internet. And when people, including council members, have asked for detailed budget information, the answer is always, we'll get back to you. But they don't. This year, the council has not pressed that at all. So I really don't know where to go next in getting that kind of budget information.
This is public money. It's not an insignificant amount of money. This is quite shocking.
I think it's shocking. And I've been in this business for 30 years, and we always complained that we didn't have good budget information. And the council and the mayor complained bitterly about it. And there really were deficiencies in the information they provided. This, of course, was at a time at the beginning before personal computers. And, you know, the computers, if you had access to a computer, it was a huge mainframe. So that technologically, it was a lot more work for the school system to produce this information. But they did better then. If someone had told me back in 1980 or 1990 that it was going to be worse in the future, I would have been astounded. How can it be worse? Well, I found out.
Now, Mayor Gray previously was chair of the council.
That's right.
And in that capacity, he did quite a lot of examination of the schools.
He did.
Asked some tough questions.
He did. And he got a lot of information. As of the spring of 2010, I had very good budget information because Mr. Gray had asked for it. And then he posted it on the council's website. It's still there. You can go onto the council's website and get a lot of detail about not only the budget but program of DCPS. But that came to an end when he was elected mayor. This has been a great disappointment because I truly expected that he would just open it all up. And I really don't know why he won't.
And it is in his control since there was mayoral control under Fenty and he brought in Chancellor Michelle Rhee. That would be his decision whether to continue to open it up.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think if he told the chief financial officer of the district schools and if he told the chancellor that they must make all this information public, they would do it. So I don't know why he doesn't tell them that.
Why do you suspect they don't do it? Are they hiding something? What do you think is going on?
Well, one never knows. And, of course, through all those early years when I was, you know, working with the school system and advocating for more money for the schools, why we would try to point out to the school system that, you know, when you hide information, people assume the worst. That's just the way it is. If you are not straightforward about something, people assume you're hiding something, even if you aren't. And I had burrowed down into their budgets because there were times when I could really get a lot of information, and the surprises were mostly pleasant. They weren't nearly as bad as people said they were. And it could be that that's what's going on here, but given the treatment of local school budgets, I don't think so. And I did do a project looking at the number of central office employees. Central office employees, by my definition, are people who do not work directly with children. Because there are people who are on the central office payroll who work directly with children, school psychologists and speech therapists and visiting teachers and all that. And I don't count those people. And I testified about how large the number seemed to be. And Kwame Brown asked me, well, how does this compare with prior years? And I said, well, that's a good question. So I went back to my old spreadsheets, and I took out all the functions that had been transferred out of DC public schools, because over the years they transferred out all their security personnel, they transferred out all the people who did state education functions. In 2009, they transferred out transportation. So there's been a tremendous decrease in the number of DCPS employees because of functions being transferred out or contracted out, like security.
Transferred out to the individual schools?
Transferred out to other government agencies. OSSE now handles transportation. OSSE handles the state education functions. Security was contracted out. Food service was contracted out. So I went back to my old spreadsheets and I took all those people out of the prior year's calculations and I compared. And while DCPS enrollment was going down from 2007 to the year when I did this, the number of central office employees was rising. And I even went back to, I think it was 1981, which was when I first got involved. And for the same functions, you know, we have more employees now in the central office, even though we have only half the number of students.
And these folks are making not an insignificant amount of money.
No, there are, as of last year, there were 100 central office employees who are making $100,000 a year or more. Kwame Brown also asked me, well, how does that compare with earlier years? And so I went back. I can't remember whether it was to 2005 or 2007, but it was before the takeover. And I counted the number of people after doing an inflation adjustment, because, of course, you would expect more people to be making more money. There were 9 people in the central office who made that kind of money, inflation adjusted. And now there are 100. And the DCEPS website has a long list of central office officials, you know, whom they're looking to hire. Now, they have a fair amount of turnover, and some of those may be replacements, but they may even be planning to increase it. And, I mean, they were advertising for chiefs of staff for all sorts of officials in the school system, and then there were to be deputy chiefs of staff. And it was really, I thought, a shocking list. Now, most of these people who have been added, if you look at the specific functions that they're performing, are doing what's called instructional support. Most of them are supervising or training or evaluating teachers and principals. That's what they're doing. So we have a small army of people who are looking at teachers and principals. They don't deal with children, these people. They deal with children, I count them as school-based, no matter who's paying them. And even if they have an office downtown but are seeing children every day, as, for example, the people who do special education evaluations, they see children every day, and I don't count them as central office. But that's where the big increase has been. And of course, that goes along with the approach of this administration, because their thesis is that we need a great teacher in every classroom. And none of us would disagree with that. But there's considerable disagreement over how you achieve that end. But that's what they're counting on. You know, after 4 years, we still don't have a curriculum. And different people feel different ways about curriculum in the school system. Some people think of it as sort of putting teachers into handcuffs. You know. But a good curriculum and a good approach to curriculum provides teachers with curriculum as a tool. And they use it and they adjust it if they're good. I saw this when my children were in school in the 70s and 80s. And what curriculum was doing was putting a floor under weaker teachers. But it was not used to impair the performance of really good teachers who wanted to go at it a different way. So fine. DCPS abandoned its curriculum in the early 90s. We haven't had curriculum since then. And after 4 years with the mayoral takeover, we still don't have a curriculum. And I would have thought that was one of the first things that they would do, because the idea is if you know where you're going, you have standards, you have a curriculum that helps teachers implement the standards, you have professional development that's aligned to the curriculum, the standards, and the assessments, and you have aligned assessment. Clifford Janey put into place standards. He did a lot of the standards work. Ossie continued it after the mayoral takeover. Our standards get very high ratings. Of course, we're now abandoning them for the Common Core standards. But our standards got very high ratings. But after 4 years, nobody developed curriculum that matched those standards. So teachers were left to either just develop their own, but also to teach to the test. And as Valerie Strauss pointed out in one of her columns in the Washington Post, the administration started telling teachers which areas of the standards were going to be covered in the particular DC CAS tests at the end of the year. So the teachers had a very strong incentive not to bother with the rest of the standards. This is all very unfortunate. It's been a great disappointment.
You mentioned how curriculum shouldn't be putting teachers in handcuffs. When I think of teachers in handcuffs, I think of teaching to the test, which you mentioned, and the pressure on teachers. This is really the Michelle Rhee reform. It's heavily focused on testing. And
that's right.
Is her second now, Kaya Henderson, is chancellor. And while Gray portrayed himself as a real difference than Mayor Fenty, he seems to be, as you said, following that example. But the pressure on teachers, talk about that and the erasure marks, these cheating on testing that we've seen, seems prevalent. It's been in D.C. and elsewhere.
Well, it may be, but we haven't had much of an investigation yet. For years and years, we have heard anecdotes about cheating on the tests. They tended to be second or third hand, and we would sort of pass them on to school system officials, but that was all we could do. We didn't have any names or anything like that. And whether they did something with it, I don't know. There has always been some degree of cheating. However, once the impact system came into place, it tremendously increased the incentive to cheat, because people were in fear of their jobs. And there are so many factors that go into how students do on tests, factors that are beyond the control of the teachers, that I think we were going to have more people yielding to that temptation. And of course, it's not just the teachers, but the principals, because throughout the administration that came into place in 2007, principals have been judged largely by the test scores at their schools, and I have been told by principals that they would go to an annual meeting with Michelle Rhee, and she was only interested in one question: how much are you going to increase your test scores? Now, my reaction to that as a parent, when people used to propose that, was I would not want my children in a school where the principal was judged by test scores. I didn't think they would get a good education. But now that's what's happening. And principals get fired all the time. We're down to, there's only a very small fraction of the principals who were in place in 2007 who are still in the system. And some principals who have been dismissed should have been gone a long time ago, but there were others who were good. And people can be dismissed for any arbitrary reason if somebody doesn't like them. That happens. So, like I said, there is a much greater incentive to cheat. Because if you are dismissed, you're pretty much, at least in this economy, rendered unemployable. Principals who have been fired from D.C. have, for the most part, not been able to get other jobs, even if they're good. So I think when we look at the accusations and the evidence of erasures on tests, we need to consider the principals as well as the teachers. And one factor there is that if a teacher is going to cheat on her own, she has to do it in the presence of a lot of people. And it wouldn't be at all surprising if some children went home and said, "Oh, mommy, the teacher was giving the kids answers." It only takes one child like that with a parent who will report it. So there's sort of more security in that. If there's to be cheating by looking at the tests in advance, or if there's to be cheating by taking tests and erasing the answers, it's hard to see how that can happen without, you know, some collaboration in the school office, maybe not the principal, but all it would take is one clerk or one assistant principal, you know, somebody else who had the key. The tests are passed out in advance of the time they're administered. They are proctored by people in the school. I don't know whether teachers change classrooms, but I really don't know. But they are proctored by people in the school. They are then collected, and they're kept in the school for several days. They're supposed to be under lock and key, but who knows? And so the opportunity is there. But you do have to have somebody, I think, who can collaborate. In the classroom, If there are erasures in the classroom, you could get it because the teacher suggested to the student that he erase that answer. And that probably did happen sometimes. But it's speculation, but I just don't see as a practical matter how the bigger problem and the more frequent problem doesn't lie beyond the administration in the classroom.
What did USA Today say when they looked at it? There's a better chance of winning the lottery than if all those erasure marks had been by chance. They were going from wrong to right answers.
That's right. And that's, I think this emphasis is truly distorting educational practice, and that's a shame.
And I'm guessing that some of this will be used to blame teachers, which is, it would be exactly a continuation of everything else that has taken place in the last years here.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate. There was a very interesting piece, and I can't remember whether it was in Valerie Strauss's column or in Education Week, but it was written by a teacher in Pennsylvania about why I cheated. And she said, well, I know it was wrong, but I really felt like I was helping the students because it demoralized them to have such low scores when I knew that they were really better than that. So people have all kinds of justifications that they can come up with for themselves. And of course, when people have a true belief in their goal, they sometimes yield to the temptation that the end justifies the means, as in people who would blow up buildings to stop the war in Vietnam, killing innocent people. So we know that happens, and I do think there's some of that.
And if you don't, you might not have a job.
That's right. That's the personal interest. But I think people also develop some, you could call them excuses if you want, but anyway, some feeling that I have to do this, it's for the children. I know some people are going to get hurt. I know this is not really right in the short term, but in the interest of our long-term goal, we have to do this because we are the ones who can save the children.
Mary Lee, we talked about the high turnover for principals. Talk about the turnover for teachers.
We lose half of our new teachers, our new hires. I'm not saying they're all new to teaching, but new to the system. We lose half of them within 2 years of their hiring. This is, of course, expensive because it costs money to recruit. We have a lot of teachers in their first 3 years of teaching. We have a lot at the high end and very few in between. This does not bode well for the future, because if we keep losing teachers after they come in, and certainly for the first and second year teachers, those are the years when people make their early teaching mistakes. I've read dozens of accounts by well-recognized and well-regarded teachers all over the national press about how hard it was when they first started and how it took them time to learn. And it's not just learning how to teach, but it's also learning how to manage a classroom. When I was a child, our schools were run like prisons. Classroom management was not much of an issue because they were run like prisons. We don't do that anymore, and we shouldn't. But the genie is out of the bottle. And if children are not motivated, they can take over. And it takes great skill to keep a whole classroom full of children interested in what you're saying, paying attention, behaving themselves. Because it only takes two or three to disrupt. Most kids do not disrupt, but two or three will. Complain to students. So I think a teacher has to be highly skilled to do that, and they have to learn to do it. This is, maybe the occasional career switcher out of the military can manage it, but you have to learn, and it differs at different ages. So it's a very great waste to have most teachers leaving after a few years. And the rate has been rising steadily. I can't remember the number, unfortunately. I can send it to you, but I can't remember the number on teacher turnover for the whole workforce. I've got a couple of spreadsheets that show that, as well as the distribution of teachers. The highest number of inexperienced teachers are in the schools of wards 1, 5, and 8. And, you know, those all have a lot of low-income kids. The lowest rates are in Ward 3, and I believe 2. 2 is, of course, a very mixed ward in terms of socioeconomics of the schools. But we're losing more teachers, of course, from the low-income schools. And again, this affects the quality of education. For some years, people would call and say, can you tell me what a good school is that's not in a rich neighborhood, but does well? And so I would sort of look for schools like that. And what I observed was that the outlier schools tended to have principals who stayed for a long time. And they built a faculty with whom they could work. And they built a consistent approach across the school. Their teachers generally liked them very much. And the students did much better than would be predicted by their background factors. You know, for example, schools that had a lot of children with limited English proficiency. Schools with a lot of low-income students, particularly kids who came from public housing, who are generally the poorest of the poor. That just doesn't happen anymore. Every year, at least 25% of our schools open with a new principal in place. And principals, having a great principal is probably even more important than having a great teacher in every classroom, because a great principal can make mediocre teachers into good teachers and good teachers into excellent ones. And now that we have impact, that's very important, because the principals do 3 evaluations a year of teachers. So you want to have a really high quality principal in every school. One who will recognize excellence, who will build a team, who will be fair. A principal who's tough but fair, like any boss, does better and is better regarded than one who is nice but plays favorites. So that's very important. And I don't see how we can get that with the kind of churn we've been having. And many of the principals that Michelle Ray brought in have left. So I just have to question, I don't know whether it's the judgment about the quality of the principal in the hiring process, or whether it's like the principal from Hearst, who left saying he just could not deal with the central administration anymore. But either way, it is not a good sign.
Mary Levy, where does Teach for America fit into all this, which some people call Teach for a While?
Yes. Well, when Teach for America first came to the district, I was enthusiastic about it because I thought it would attract some good people into teaching and fill holes, because that's really what Teach for America started out as. They were recruiting what they called top college graduates who would be in a school in place of substitutes. I also knew some people who had been through TFA and went on. They would go to law school or public policy school and then would go on to do things maybe in school administration, and I thought it was much better that people in those positions be somebody who had experienced the classroom. And in the budget office in DCPS, for example, we had several people who had been through Teach for America elsewhere and had gone to public policy school. And they were wonderful. They were very responsive to parents. They understood the kinds of effects that their decisions had on education. And that was just fine. But I think Teach for America has changed because it's expanded so much. And they now seem to be into replacing teachers, not filling holes. And there are just too many of them that move on. And that's their commitment, is 2 years. So you can't really blame them. I think we would be much better off if we called for 4 or 5 years commitment. Because if it's just a resume builder, and I think that's happening more. I think at the beginning, you had more people who were likely to go into it for unselfish reasons, and who really wanted to make a career of teaching. But I think now, particularly with the economy the way it is, I keep seeing articles in the newspaper about how college graduates are having trouble getting jobs. Well, you can go to Teach for America and you get a job. And it's a job that pays decently. You don't get rich being a teacher, but it's a decent paying job. You put it on your resume. You don't really have to worry about your evaluations if you're planning to move on. But I also think that the people who come from these elite colleges and universities are the kind of people who don't really want to accomplish their goals, however unselfish, one classroom at a time. I give the example of one of my daughters who had a double major in American history and social work. And at the end of undergraduate school, she said, "I'm not going to be a social worker because I can't do this one case at a time. I want to do something systemic. I want to fix the system." And I think that's the way a lot of the Teach for America teachers are. They want to have a bigger impact. And in all fairness, when you look at the state of education, you can see that, you know, there are some things that need to be fixed systemically. But that doesn't help the kids in the classroom right now. And I think that we need teachers who will stick with it. And I think Teach for America has gotten too big. I think it concentrates too much on elite schools. There's a wonderful article by a professor of education at Fordham talking about why he doesn't allow Teach for America to recruit in his classrooms. He said he had been enthusiastic, but Teach for America hardly ever accepted his students. And, you know, Fordham is not a bad school. And he said these schools that they're staffing, they need people who come out of the community. There's a very funny article on a website called Last Stand for Children First about Teach for America and the kinds of people they recruit. And I don't know, does your typical graduate of Yale know what to do with a Ward 8 school? Probably not. I mean, Marion Barry has raised a lot of concern about that, and in talking about highly effective teachers, for that matter, has said he doesn't assume that transferring teachers out of Ward 3 schools will improve Ward 8 schools, because they might not do that well in Ward 8 schools. So I think they need to look a lot more to the kinds of communities that are those of the children themselves. I mean, let's maybe look at some teachers from Morgan State who grew up in inner city Baltimore or inner city DC. I think they would have an easier time figuring out how to relate to the kids than your typical graduate of Harvard or the University of Michigan, places like that. So, I mean, I see a role for Teach for America, but I'd like to see them change their practice a lot. And I'd like them to keep themselves smaller, because we need people who stay in it.
Mary Levy, in your testimony, and one of the follow-up questions was asked, what your thoughts on Mary Che, the Ward 3 council member. You mentioned Ward 8, which is one of the probably the poorest ward, mm-hmm. African-American Ward 3, largely white, wealthiest ward in Northwest D.C. And Ward 3 is looking at building an additional middle school. One of the testimony also was from Maria Jones, and she's in Ward 5. Ward 5 doesn't have a single public middle school. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about de facto segregation if we're not careful. Talk about the kind of, well, Mayor Gray ran on the campaign of one city, but when it comes to education, is that what you see?
I would like to go back to the most recent statistics on diversity in the school system. Some years ago, I did a lot of work on a report that looked at what had happened in DC public schools since Brown v. Board of Education. I think we did that in 2004. And there was not a lot of integration in DC public schools anymore. That was mainly because there were so few white students. And although they tended to be concentrated in a limited number of schools, they were a minority in almost all the schools. You know, when my daughters went to Wilson High School, the white percentage there ranged between 13 and 15%. At Deal, it was about 5% higher. They were a strong minority in their elementary schools, and these were west of the park schools. Since that time, we have a lot more children living in schools west of the park. There was a time when people were actually proposing to consolidate Murch and Lafayette because they had so few neighborhood students. Well, because of child population increase in Ward 3, the neighborhood schools are getting more and more filled with neighborhood children. Now that means less room for out-of-boundary students. And that's what I would like to go back and look at. Long ago, the white children were in the Capitol Hill area, but they were a very strong minority. And then west of the park, they were a minority in most of the schools they were in. So we had some integrated schools, not very many, because most schools were about 100% black, and if there was diversity, it came from the Latinos. But now there's been a lot of demographic change, and since we have the 2010 census, it's really time to go back and take a look at, okay, where do the children live? I can remember a time when people like us would never go to 14th and U, or for that matter to 18th and T at night, Northwest. To most of Columbia Heights. And now, you go to those places and there are white people all over the place. The city's demographics are really changing. My concern is that because of the way the real estate market works, that we're going to continue to have mostly white neighborhoods in some places, maybe mostly black neighborhoods in other places, and then neighborhoods that are integrated but only temporarily, because the middle class black population gets priced out. And in fact, I have been told by one principal that her school, which is sort of upper northwest but east of the park, has been losing its Latino students because their families are priced out. They can't afford to live there anymore. And I'd love to see those neighborhoods continue to be diverse, but I'm not sure the real estate market will permit it. Now, of course, if we have mostly de facto segregated neighborhoods and we have neighborhood schools, and that's where people have to go, then most people will be in de facto segregated schools. And it's not just by race. It's also by class and income. Because, again, the way the real estate market works, people in the same income level tend to cluster together. And so I wish everybody could have the diversity experience that my children had when they were in D.C. public schools. I don't know if the same proportion of children now do or not, whether there are more or fewer. And it's certainly hard to tell how, you know, the rapidly changing demographics will affect it, because it used to be that in many neighborhoods, young professional people would move in before they had children. And then once they had children and the children approached school age, they would leave the district for the suburbs. Apparently that's changing. I look at Columbia Heights and I sort of see Park Slope in Brooklyn, where there are lots and lots of children in the streets, and there's a waiting list at the local public school, even for people in Boundary. And so it may be that, you know, just urban living is becoming popular again. And if that happens, that will be different than the circumstances under which my children grew up.
And while there are more kids now, maybe in Columbia Heights, there's always, I think there's always been a lot of kids, and there certainly are a lot of kids east of the river, Ward 5.
Yes.
And yet the money for the schools is more invested, and this was exacerbated under Michelle Rhee, much more north and west.
Well, in terms of per pupil funding, it was sort of random. There were enormous differences in per pupil spending among schools of the same size, of the same kind, and different, but it really appeared to be random. However, the capital spending really has been concentrated in the Northwest. As of, I can't remember if it's this fall or next fall, 75% of the students in Ward 3 schools will be in fully modernized buildings. That is far, far higher than in any place else in the city. And Ward 2 is rising up. Ward 4 was very disfavored for reasons I can't understand. But it was, and capital money, according to the expert I know who studies these things, Some of that money for Ward 3 schools and recreation facilities was taken out of projects that had been planned east of the river. I mean, this is just not fair. Wilson moved up the list for modernization, and goodness knows it needed it. But then there were high schools elsewhere in the city that got moved down the list, and they needed it just as much, if not more. So that's just not fair. It's where the votes are. And I wish we could get beyond that because, you know, all children need good facilities. And we can't do it all at once and everywhere at once, but at least it ought to be done evenly. And we should probably look to do it first for the students who need it the most. You know, Wilson, when my children went there, was in the most awful condition. Girls didn't use the bathrooms. They went across the street to Sears. There weren't any doors on the stalls. Some of them didn't have toilet seats. Plaster was falling off the walls. It was in very bad shape. But my children, and most of the kids at Wilson, did not come from public housing that looked like that, or apartments that looked like that. They sort of took it for granted that, well, you know, these schools are not in very good shape, so what? I think that in low-income neighborhoods, when the schools are in very bad shape, that sends a message to those kids that nobody cares about them, that they just aren't important enough. And if those schools have proper facilities, and if you want to talk to Mary Filardo of 21st Century about it, you know, she's very big on saying what good facilities can do for education. Those are the kids who need it. They also, of course, have more problems with crime and vandalism, that kind of thing, and so they need more maintenance. And things may have to be renovated more often. But I think if those schools can be an island for even kids from the hardest circumstances, where they can feel secure, where they feel that they're valued, that the school is cheerful, I think that makes a difference. I think it also can make a difference in keeping some of the people who have choices in the neighborhood. I think that the shiny new schools in Ward 3 have had a considerable impact in more parents there sending their children to the DC schools.
That some money, more money went to the wealthiest areas for capital.
For capital.
Isn't it not been reported really at all? And that aspect of the Michelle Rhee reforms was not really reported.
Right. Now that was actually, I don't know how much of that was Michelle Rhee's idea and how much of it was Mayor Fenty's idea, because of course the capital planning was done by the Office of Public Education Facilities Modernization, which is separate from the school system. I think that Michelle Rhee had considerable amount to say, but nobody really knows whether she was responsible for that.
And my question was about the media coverage of that aspect of the reform, or lack thereof.
Yes, well, there has been almost no media coverage, and the Washington Post published an article which was supposed to destroy the so-called myth that there was more capital money being spent west of Rock Creek Park and in similar neighborhoods. And they did have statistics for recreation facilities, which showed that it pretty much was evenly distributed, but they had no figures at all for schools. They just went on anecdotes and assertions. Mary Filardo, who knows more about this than anybody else in the city, wrote a rebuttal laying out the evidence. The Post refused to run it. And it was never really picked up by anybody. But I really think we need to look again at, you know, the facilities planning to see that it really is equitably distributed. And equity doesn't mean that everybody gets exactly the same. It means that the people who need it the most, whether it's the students or whether it's the building, need to get it first. And we also need a robust planning process. We really have to figure out how we're going to handle facilities planning, particularly given the number of charter schools. Charter schools receive a facilities allowance, which is supposed to do the same things as capital funding does for DCPS. And for the most part, they have to spend it on private facilities. They'd prefer to use excess space in DC public schools, which were built for that purpose, but they've not had nearly as much success as they want anyway in getting that space. They haven't sought to displace kids, but there is several million square feet of excess space in DCPS schools. And so they go to the private sector, and some of them are buying buildings. This is all public money. And so we're spending all this public money building other facilities. And we really need to figure out how we can make the best use of that money so that we don't have excess space and we do have schools where people need them and that they're good facilities that are appropriate for their functions. And I have not seen that happening. And unfortunately, I have not seen very much chance for the public to participate in the facilities planning. Well, you know, the public pays for it. It's the public that sends their children to these buildings. They know what they want. I know that both the Eastern High School and the Wilson High School modernizations were done with a lot of parent participation, and I think it made a real difference in the kind of work that was done. Well, we need this all over the city. People really have to be involved in it, or we may be building facilities that people don't want to use. That would be unfortunate. And again, I just don't know where that's going, whether we will have a proper planning process. We especially need it for middle schools, because the planning process doesn't involve just, well, where do we put facilities? What should they have in them? You build facilities to match educational needs, and you start with the educational needs. And I don't know whether that's being done. You also, since we have so many buildings, sometimes it's cheaper to tear down the old and build a new. Other times it's better to keep the old and modernize it. But, you know, when do you do one? When do you do the other? What do you do with the kids who are displaced while construction is going on? I think that was something that really hurt Hardy Middle School, being off over by the DC car impoundment lot in Northeast. I mean, who wants to go all the way over there if you live miles away? So I think we need a lot of careful thought and we need to try to look ahead to see where we're going. And the bricks and mortar need to follow that, not precede it.
On charter schools, I think before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, D.C. was number one in charter schools. And now, I think, I don't know if we're up to New Orleans, but this is pretty close to ground zero for the charter school movement. What are your thoughts on charter schools?
I have always supported charter schools in D.C. I do not know what the situation is elsewhere. But for a long time, you know, the charter schools in D.C. pretty much came out of community. Paul Charter School, which testified here this morning, that was a D.C. junior high school. And their principal had done a magnificent job. She had doubled the enrollment at that school. The achievement was up. People felt really good about it. And I think that they were afraid that when this principal retired, D.C. Public Schools was going to send them somebody, and the school would just sort of go back down again. And they said, we want to keep things the way they are. And so they got the necessary signatures, two-thirds of the families, two-thirds of the faculty, to convert to a charter school. And that's what they did. I mean, this was the people from that school community. And a lot of the other schools pretty much came out of the community. And they might hire these outside firms to do things, what they would call the management functions. Because a charter school is like a small business. You know, you have to do payroll, all kinds of human resources things. You know, you have to keep it heated and lit. And there's all kinds of things you have to do that don't really relate to education. You also have to manage your money. And so they would hire these outside companies to do that, but for the most part, you know, they were on top of them. In other words, you know, they still belonged. I also saw the charter schools here as a means of escape from a dysfunctional D.C. public school system. And so that we had some families and also some teachers and principals who just couldn't take it anymore in D.C. public schools. This was before the mayoral takeover. And instead of going to the suburbs, or in some instances private schools, they went to charter schools. And the charter schools, by law, have to take anybody who applies. Although, like many D.C., as long as they have the grade for them, they have to take anyone who applies. Now, like many D.C. public schools, they have their ways and means of attracting and rejecting students. I mean, that's gone on in the Ward 3 schools for years. Any old buddy can't get into Ward 3 schools, please. So, you know, to the extent that that's going on, it's a fault in both systems. I think the biggest problem we have to face right now is what to do about a system where we really have two separate systems, one of which is not even allowed to serve particular neighborhoods, and how they're to relate to each other. Because if the enrollment at DCPS becomes too thin, there is no way that students will be able to have a school that they can go to by right that they can get to. I mean, that's part of the reason that we have under-enrolled schools in many neighborhoods, is that there are just not enough children in the in a reasonable area who are enrolled in those schools. If they're in charter schools, you know, that does impact the local school, and not everybody can get into a charter school, and the fact that you live across the street from it means nothing. So, you know, what are we going to do about that? We really need to look at that whole question. When charter schools started, nobody ever imagined there would be so many. It's a tremendous amount of work to start a charter school. I mean, these big private firms, which operate elsewhere, particularly the for-profit ones, you know, they have their templates and their models. It's not a lot of work for them. But for community people, it is a lot of work to start a charter school. And we never thought that so many people would come forward. And when they started coming forward, there were more than anybody thought would appear. We thought, well, you know, there's just sort of a backlog of frustrated people. Because, you know, a lot of teachers and principals were very frustrated by the DCPS administration, and they couldn't get anything done about it. There were parents all over the city who just poured their hearts into trying to make their schools better and got no response. So why shouldn't they want to go out and start a charter school? But we couldn't imagine that there would be that many. But they just kept coming. And I think had that been anticipated, I think the law might have been set up differently. I think planning could have been done differently. And that's why, as a city, we need to step back and look at that. I have also heard secondhand, by the way, that there are charter school leaders who wish that they could come back into DCPS if DCPS had a different approach. But they value their autonomy. They are not going to go to a system where the management services are often not very good, where there's arbitrary treatment from downtown. And some of that has increased since the mayoral takeover. Well, people's children only get one chance. So that's why I've been very sympathetic to charter schools. But I really think that as a community, we need to rethink the whole thing and figure out, you know, how can we work this together? I would like to see a system much more like the one in Edmonton, Canada, which has all kinds of schools in it. The schools have an enormous amount of autonomy. And the way it was done there, it substantially improved the school's enrollment and their performance. Because the community of each school has so much to say about what goes on in that school. And that, to me, is one of the big defects in DCPS, is that the parents and the teachers in many schools don't have very little to say about what happens in that school. If we could change that, I don't think we'd have so many charter schools. I think some of them would come in. I don't think more would start up. If you look out in the suburbs, they have hardly any charter schools. They don't need them.
I think they said not one. They were talking today about charter schools. I think they said not one in Ward 3. They went through the map of charter schools.
Right.
That was shocking because there was a whole lot of them.
Yeah. Well, I also think that the Public Charter School Board, one of the criteria that they're supposed to look at in chartering schools is, well, is there a need for it? There's no reason to think that there's a need for it in Ward 3.
One of the aspects that I'm interested in your answer about charter schools having kind of a local grassroots impetus for starting, because my reading about charter schools is there's a lot of big time money.
Yes, there is.
Coming in that is not local.
I'm not sure it's coming in here. I mean, in fact, the big time money that's coming in here is going to DCPS. to fund impact. You know, $64 million. I mean, charter schools are not getting that kind of money.
$25 million, if I'm remembering, from the Walmart Foundation, which is now attempting to bring in four or five stores, and the Broad Foundation.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really very worried about this study that's proposed, or that is being done by an Illinois firm, because I look at their reports in other cities, and they always recommend that charter school operators be recruited from elsewhere. I think that's a big mistake. If we want to increase the number of charter schools, let's recruit in our own communities. I think the better answer, though, is to make DC schools, DC public schools, more appealing, to treat our principals and teachers and parents with greater respect. If we treated them with greater respect, and if we listened more to what they want in their schools, I think we would have fewer charter schools.
Just as I said the words, it occurred to me, yes, that $64.5 million was for DCPS. However, part of it was tied to keeping Michelle Rhee there. And she was a very big promoter and friendly to charter school. So I'm not sure it was...
Well, you know, she was a big promoter verbally. Uh-huh. She didn't do a thing for them substantively when she was chancellor. The charter school people did not care for her.
What drives you, Mary Levy? You've been for years coming, testifying, poring over the data, getting these numbers. When you speak, the council members, they know that they're dealing with someone who has studied issues far more than they ever have. What drives you?
Well, originally it was my own children. They were in DC public schools in first and third grade when we had a big fiscal crisis. The school got turned upside down, and I had been doing education finance lawsuits in Maryland and New York, and so I stepped in as somebody who knew about financial matters, and you know, I wanted, you know, my children to have more, but I also wanted other children to have more. I worked for probably the country's leading small civil rights firm, which was right here in Washington, D.C. And I just felt strongly about equity for all children. The work itself was more fun than the Sunday crossword puzzle in the New York Times. I genuinely liked to pore over data. I was originally trained as an academic before I went to law school, and I love doing research, and I love looking at the data and hunting for truth, and I can do that. And so that's one of the things that keeps me going. But also, I have to say that I receive an enormous amount of appreciation. And when I think about moving on, because since I'm now unemployed, I may eventually have to go to my fourth career. This is my third. And yet I think, well, you know, there are parents, you know, who come up to me and they thank me. And I say, you know, they really need me to keep doing this. And I enjoy the work, and I feel like I'm needed. I never have done the work for a paycheck. Not that I didn't need one, but that wasn't why I was doing it. I didn't think of work as something. The paycheck came along, but I did the work. I thought I was extremely lucky to have a job where I was eager to come to work in the morning, even though I hate to get up. So that all keeps me going. And the appreciation's an important part of it. And, you know, people come up and they hug me. So I say, well, I must be doing them some good.
Thanks for so much for your time.